Netzer's work goes much more deeply into particular. It's the most important contribution is to partial differential equations, such as those that occur in relativity. So anyway, when this paper makes its appearance, I highly recommend it as well. So we have a basic picture here, starting with the manifold P. We can, on the one hand, have the momentum map, and on the other side, and we've seen, of course, we've seen variants of this. In Yendre's talk, he explained how sometimes you just want to look at the left-hand side of this diagram, whether or not there is a momentum map or not. But when there is a momentum map, this is a very nice picture, which is sometimes known as a dual pair, especially if P is a symplectic manifold. And in the nicest situations, this has the property that if you pull back the C infinity functions on the quotient, so either maybe the quotient's a nice manifold, in which case this literally makes sense. Otherwise, you define it as simply the G invariant functions on P. And then you also look at J star of C infinity of G star, that these two subspaces of C infinity of P are mutual commutants of one another with respect to the Poisson bracket. In other words, everything in here commutes with anything in here, and anything which commutes with something in here is in here, and vice versa. That's not always precisely true, but in nice cases where, for example, these maps are submersions and have, or at least constant rank maps and have connected fibers, then this is literally true. And it should also remind one of the situation of, one consequence of this is if you take the double commutant of one of these spaces, then it's equal to itself, the commutant of the commutant. This establishes a link with a theory of operator algebras, where these algebras are called von Neumann algebras. And quantization is somehow, and systems with symmetry is somehow a way of promoting this double commutant relation to some kind of operators. In particular, this so-called quantization commutes with reduction statement. So Ortega and Ratiu took this thing very seriously and used it more or less as the definition of what they call their optimal momentum map. What do you have to begin with? What you have to begin with is this. And so what you do is you take this algebra of functions, and then you more or less define, you take this one, because that's what you have without a momentum, that's what you get just from the action. You take this algebra of functions, and then you more or less define the momentum map so that this thing is going to be the commutant. And of course you might not see all of G star. In general, this map J is not surjective, and so you'll only see, the functions which vanish on the image of J don't make any difference, and so you'll really usually get some kind of a quotient. This, in other words, this map here, this J star is not injective. You only get some kind of a quotient of J star sitting in here, which means that you'll only really be seeing a kind of sub thing of G star if there were an actual momentum map. But the idea of Ortega and Ratiu is simply to take the functions that are invariant under all the Hamiltonian flows of invariant functions and to think of those as being the functions on some kind of substitute for G star, and that's what they call the universal or the optimal momentum map. And it satisfies a kind of universal property that whenever you have something that behaves like a momentum map, namely that it's conserved by the flow of any invariant Hamiltonian, then that map factors through this optimal momentum map. So this was very abstract, but they were able to show that if the action is proper, if G acts properly on P, then the fibers of the, I'll write OMM for optimal momentum map, the fibers of the optimal momentum map are the connected components their work was motivated by the fact that somehow more was conserved by Hamiltonian flows than just the levels of the momentum map. In particular, the connected components would be conserved because we're looking at flows. But also the isotropy type was conserved. In other words, if you look at the set of all points in P, which have the same isotropy type, and again, to answer the question that Jerry asked in Yendre's talk, again, it's not the orbit type, it's not things which have the same conjugacy class of isotropy, but the same isotropy on the nodes. So this is intersection, say, P sub, I think Yendre used a notation something like this yesterday. This is the set of all elements of P whose isotropy group is some given subgroup H. So there's this very nice result that for proper action, one can identify exactly what this quotient is. And what's nice about this is that if you forget about the connected components, we recover one of the virtues of the original momentum map, which is that the target of the original momentum map is independent of the action. What always seems to me a little bit disconcerting about the optimal momentum map is that you don't know where it's going until you actually have the action. So that doesn't prevent it from being a useful tool, but it's somehow, from a conceptual point of view, it seems like something is missing. So here we're doing a little better in that that we can sort of describe in quite concrete terms what these fibers of the optimal momentum map are. You might say there's a map. There's a bigger map, a sort of an extended J. Instead of just going from the manifold to G star, it goes from the manifold to G star cross the set of subgroups of the symmetry group G. And so for this sort of extended momentum map, we might call it the isotropy momentum map, to paraphrase Snell's energy momentum map. If you look at the isotropy momentum map, then the level sets of this up to connected components are exactly the fibers of the optimal momentum map. But what's missing from this is the role of S of G and how where it sort of comes from in some sense. We know that, I mean, G star, well, of course, G star also sort of came out of nowhere in some sense. If you didn't know to look at G star, it's not obvious that that should be the target of a momentum map. But what I want to show you now is that introducing certain groupoids not only gives another way of looking at the G star, the role of G star, but also the role of the S of G. So one does have to do, I mean, you have to introduce some structures that aren't necessarily there to begin with, but these structures seem to be very natural in the context of group actions. So let me give a little crash course on groupoids for those of you who either haven't heard me talk about them or it's been long enough that you've forgotten. So a groupoid is going to be, a groupoid is a generalization of groups in which the typical element, rather than, you should think of, if you think of groups as transformations from a set to itself, group or elements of groupoids are transformations from some set to some other set. And so we depict a groupoid element by an arrow. So a groupoid is going to be something gamma, and it's going to have, there's going to be sort of two parts to it. There's the element of the elements which are represented by arrows, and then there's gamma zero, which are the endpoints of these arrows. And there's two maps from gamma one to gamma zero called the source and the target. This is going to be the target of G. This is the source of G. And often we identify gamma with this set of arrows, and this thing is sometimes called the base. And typically, this is going to be identified with some other space of interest, M. So we talk about gamma being a groupoid over M. So X and Y are points of M. The G's are some objects to which we associate initial and terminal points. With some rules of composition, so that in particular, if I have an H such that the source of H is the target of G, then I can form the product HG, and this is associative. And what's more, every element has an inverse with respect to some identity element sitting at each of the elements of gamma zero. So for multiplication, the way we introduce that is we let gamma 2 be the set of GH such that the source of G is the target of H. And then multiplication is a map from here to gamma, which satisfies the obvious requirements for associativity. And then you can introduce inverses and, well, identities, and then inverses. From another point of view, this is this is exactly what mathematicians would call a category. What distinguishes a groupoid from the general category is, first of all, that all the elements are assumed to have inverses, and secondly, that the set of all these things here are really actually sets rather than some weird higher set theoretical things like the collection of all manifolds, something like that. For us, these groupoids are going to be themselves finite dimensional manifolds.
Do you have an example where?
Yeah, so let me give some examples of these things right away. The first example is M cross M, sometimes called the pair groupoid. In which this is going to be gamma 1, and gamma 0 is just M. The source and target maps are the two projections, and the multiplication rule is simply xy times yz is xz. And the inverse of xy is yx. The identities are the points on the diagonal. This is a very fundamental, it's a very important groupoid. It turns out that some of the constructions in discrete that Jerry and his colleagues and students have been working on in discrete Lagrangian systems fit very well into the theory of groupoids when you apply it to this very simple example here. Another example, class of examples are, of course, groups in which gamma zero is a point so that you can compose everything. Another example, which will be basic for us, is the situation where we have a group G acting on M, And then we'll let so we'll let gamma 0 be m again. Gamma 1 is going to be g cross m, which we're going to identify with a set of triples, x, g, g, x, such that g is in g and x is in m. So in other words, what's an arrow here? We have a space M on which the group is acting, and a typical arrow is a group element labeling an arrow from the place where the group element is acting to the place where the group takes that element. So y is equal to gx. Then it's not hard to see. And so the source is going to be, this is going to be the source, I'm sorry, x is the source and gx is the target. And all the group-wide axioms hold very simply. Whenever you have a groupoid, you can talk about orbits. Two things are in the same orbit if there's an arrow connecting them. In this case, the orbits are just the orbits of the group action. Whenever you have a groupoid, there's an for any point in the base, there's an isotropy group consisting of all the arrows from the point to itself. In this case, the isotropy group is just the isotropy group in the group action sense. Another important class of examples are the fundamental groupoids. If M is a topological space, we can let gamma 0 equal M and gamma 1 to be homotopy classes of paths with fixed endpoints. So that an element of this groupoid is a homotopy class of paths from x to y with homotopies fixing the endpoints. The orbits are the connected components, and the isotropy group is the fundamental group based at a given point. And this turns out to be a very useful way of thinking, even if you're interested only in the fundamental group. But there are situations where you don't want to fix your attention on a particular base point, then the fundamental groupoid turns out to be a useful structure. For example, if you want to compute the fundamental group of a space like this by breaking it up into pieces and then putting the pieces together, when you look at the intersection, you get something disconnected. And so you don't want to really fix a base point in that intersection. So this notion of groupoid has, for example, that kind of topological application. The other day, some time ago, I wrote an article on groupoids as models for systems with partial symmetries or internal symmetries. And the other day, Marty Golubisky told me that he and Ian Stewart are working on various network models in which the symmetries seem to be best described by groupoids. They've also turned up in crystallography for this describing symmetries of crystals in which you have layers, which each layer has a sort of standard symmetry group, but the layers are piled up on one another in a kind of disordered way so that you can have symmetries from one layer to another layer, that the objects in this groupoid are going to be the layers, one for each layer. There are going to be a lot of maps from one layer to another layer, but there are no necessarily global symmetries moving the whole crystal up and down. Anyway, to get back from general groupoids to this, it turns out that the reason, in some sense, one way of understanding the importance of G star for group actions is that it's actually the base of a groupoid. Using this idea of an action groupoid, if we look at G cross G star using the coadjoint representation, that makes this product into a groupoid. What's more, if we use, and I always forget which, I think it's left translations, we can identify this product with T star G, and it turns out that having a Hamiltonian action of G with an equivariant momentum map is essentially the same thing as having an action of this groupoid on P. Now, what's an action of a groupoid? So if I have a groupoid G, let's just call it gamma over M. I usually write it with two arrows. And if I have a space P, what does it mean for gamma to act on P? Well, first of all, we need a map from P to M, which I'll call J, and which here I will call the moment map of the groupoid action. So sometimes this can coincide with the momentum map. Sometimes it has nothing to do with momentum map. And what's going to happen is, so I'll kind of draw a schematic picture. Here's M. Here's P. I'll draw it as if it were fibered over M, but J doesn't have to be a submersion or even onto. What we're going to have is that whenever there's a groupoid morphism from X to Y, then there's going to be associated to that a map from J inverse X to J inverse Y. And these maps are going to satisfy the usual product rule for an action. In particular, the isotropic group of X is going to act on each of the fibers. And of course, for the situation that we're dealing with in Hamiltonian actions, the isotropies here are exactly those coefficients. I should call these things mu. They're going to be the coefficients on isotropy groups, and their action is the one you divide by to get the reduced manifold. So notice that in the context of groupoids, you can carry out reduction. Namely, whenever you have a groupoid action, you can simply take J inverse of, I'll call it mu, and mu is in M, and divide by G mu, where G mu now means in the groupoid, the group, the isotropic group of that point. And some years ago, Kentaro Mikami and I wrote a paper in which we showed that if you put symplectic structures on everything in sight in a way that's compatible with the groupoid actions, then you can actually do symplectic reduction, and these things will be, again, symplectic manifolds. There are some nice examples of this. I've always felt one of the examples that I've always been looking for and never found should be in relativity, because I learned a long time ago from Jerry, maybe even as early as the time that we wrote that original paper, that there's a construction in general relativity which I've forgotten now the name, but it has to do with constraints in general relativity, in which there's something that looks like a moment, there's a reduction, there's something that looks like a zero level of a momentum map, but there's no group action there. And occasionally I go back to try to find a groupoid action that will lead to that, to those constraint equations as the zero sets of this kind of a moment map for a groupoid action and hopefully a symplectic groupoid action. So now I want to get to this F of G and tell you about a groupoid that I learned about some years ago, but didn't realize how interesting it was until I saw optimal momentum maps. This is a groupoid that's almost as old as the notion of groupoid itself. Notion of groupoid goes back to Brandt in the 1920s, and in 1929, Reinhold, I have to ask one of the German colleagues, how one properly pronounces this? Bear. Okay, so I've always pronounced it correctly. Reinhold Baer introduced a very interesting notion of a groupoid in a paper called Über der Schar, I think it's Scharenbegriff, the concept of something he called a Schar, which is one of these many words in mathematics that refers to some kind of collectivity. So far as I know, there's never been an English translation, but it occurred to me that there's a term waiting out there that mathematicians haven't yet used to refer to a kind of collection. There's groups, and there are bands, and there are gerb, if you know about those things, and there are faisceau, sheaves, but nobody has introduced the notion of a bunch. So I leave it. I'm throwing it out there for anybody who finds a good use for something that we'll call a bunch. Maybe I'll take it. Is that a reasonable translation of Schar from German? So what a Schar is in a group? Well, Baer noticed that it's very interesting to look in a group, not just the multiplication operation, or even the operation that takes one element times the inverse of another, which some people use as the basis for a group, because it combines both multiplication and inverse, but the triple operation that takes x to x, y inverse z. So if you think of if this is an abelian group, and x, y, and z are points in a vector space, say, then what this is the fourth point of the parallelogram having x, y, and z as its other three vertices. And you notice that this can be drawn, I can draw this without knowing where zero is. So this is really a kind of affine geometry construction. And in this paper, Baer not only axiomatizes this operation and tells when it comes from a group, but he looks at subsets of a group which are invariant under this ternary operation. This is what he calls a bunch. And he characterizes them very simply as cosets, what we call cosets. I'm not sure if that word was in use then. And what's a coset? It's, you take a subgroup. A subgroup is obviously invariant under this. On the other hand, this operation is equivariant under left or right translations. If you multiply x, y, and z on the left by something, then this triple product gets multiplied by the same thing, similarly for multiplication on the right. So if you have something that's invariant, so if you have a subgroup and you translate it left or right to get what we call a coset, you get, again, something invariant under this ternary operation. And Baer showed that those were all of them. But he also showed something very interesting. He showed that the set of bunches, which I'll call B of G, B for Baer rather than bunch, but you can take it either way, that B of G is a groupoid. And it's a groupoid over the set of subgroups. So what's the what is this structure on the Baer groupoid? Well, if you have it's kind of cute. If you start with a coset C, then you can form C inverse C, meaning the set of all products X in, G inverse H, where G is in C. And it turns out this if this is a coset, if this is a Schar, a bunch, then this is a subgroup. On the other hand, you can take C, C inverse, and that's also a subgroup. And so you can think of C as being a morphism from C, C inverse to C inverse C. And what is this actually? How do you form C inverse C? Well, you take any element of C and you left multiply everything in C by its inverse. And so that's going to give you it's good enough to take one element and left translate it because of the closure under this triple operation. So that says if you have a coset, it's a left coset of some uniquely defined subgroup, and that's it. But it's also a right coset of some other subgroup, possibly other subgroup, and this is it. And what's the relation between these two subgroups? Well, if you take any element in here, essentially gives you conjugation from this subgroup to this subgroup. So the orbits, I haven't told you how to compose C's yet, but the orbits are the conjugacy classes of subgroups. What's the composition? Well, the composition turns out, and this is what Baer wrote, it's just CD. You just, if you have two cosets, you look at an element of C and you multiply it by an element of D. If CC inverse is equal to D inverse D, then this product is again a coset. And it's going to be so it's only going to work when C and D are cosets of things in the same conjugacy class. And they'll get you, then the left and rights of things in the same conjugacy class again. So it's a very cute construction. It's interesting that. Okay. So let me quickly say what. Let me see where this takes us. It turns out that whenever a group acts on a space, this Baer groupoid acts on that space also, with the momentum map being the map that takes every element to its isotropy. And so we can also, in that sense, we can consider this momentum map here as a momentum map for an action of the groupoid T star G across the Baer groupoid of G and this groupoid over G star cross S of G. There are connections with this. One can go from here to some of the other momentum maps that I haven't talked about. In particular, there's a momentum map that Liu and Evans introduced for actions of Poisson Lie groups, in which these conjugacy classes and cosets also occur in a very natural way. And there's lots of interesting questions, some of which I've outlined in my paper, to still try to come up with not only an optimal momentum map, but a kind of universal momentum map where the target is independent of the space on which your group is acting. Thanks.